Good morning. I'd like to thank everyone for coming this morning. The turnout is a tremendous chizuk for the Business Halacha Institute and for Rav Chaim. I certainly hope that everyone's interest in the topic is academic and that we have neither perpetrators or victims in the room. But this topic is a good example of the complexities of modern finance and how situations that arise, they're difficult from a financial perspective, they're difficult from a social perspective, but we also need to consider the halakhic perspective. And in Mirtzeh Hashem, we'll deal with some of the halakha shailos that come up in the aftermath of such scams. While most people in their daily lives are not exposed to Ponzi schemes, nevertheless, each and every person, whatever industry he is, whatever career he's chosen, is constantly faced with challenges in halacha, shailos and choshen mishpat, how to make sure your business dealings are run consistent with halacha, consistent with our values and our ideals. And that is... And that is very much the mission of the Business Halacha Institute. And everyone who's here today to listen to this year, I would encourage them to avail themselves of the many other services and resources that BHI offers. We've recently revamped our website. There are literally thousands of shiurim and articles on all aspects of modern commerce, of choshen mishpat. It's fully searchable. We're constantly adding new material. And it's something that I would encourage everyone to take a test drive. We also, throughout the year, offer numerous seminars and shiurim. They range from general interest topics to specialty areas, industry-specific, for attorneys, for hedge fund professionals, real estate professionals. And whatever industry you're in, you're sure to find something of interest. Perhaps most importantly, BHI's focus is not so much after the fact, how to pick up the pieces when a scheme occurs, but our focus is primarily on prevention. When a person is first setting up a business, entering into a transaction, it's in order to make sure that it's being structured in a way that avoids problems of Shabbos, of Ribbis. BHI offers consultations, we do mediation and arbitration, and really full service to make sure that people do not run and get into trouble in the first place. And again, it's something I encourage everyone to look into and avail themselves of the many resources that are available. Before we begin the program, I'd just like to thank the many people whose hard work and effort made it possible. Firstly, the board of BHI, Moshe and Yossi and Nicholas, whose input and support is vital for BHI to continue to function. A special thank you to Leibel, the administrator, for all of his Herculean efforts organizing and coordinating today's event. And a special thank you to our panelists, Rav Chaim David Zwiebel, Rav Aaron Twersky, who took from their valuable time in order to participate in today's event. And lastly, Achron Achron Chaviv, a special thank you to Rav Chaim Cohn, who is the force behind BHI. And our bracha and tefillah is that HaKadosh Baruch Hu should give him the kayach and the gezunt to continue his avodas HaKodesh for many, many years in the future. Without further ado, I'd like to introduce Rav Chaim David Zwiebel, who's going to moderate the panel discussion.
Thank you. Thank you, Rav Ari. And I guess since Rav Ari was the one who parceled out all the thank yous before we start the event, then let me start by saying a special thank you to Rabbi Aryan Marburger, without whom much of the work of the Business Halacha Institute could never be accomplished. Certainly today's function, having participated in some discussions and email trails back and forth, I know how hard Rabbi Aryan worked, and to be able to do so and stay in the background at the same time is a siman that he's a Talmud Muvik of his Rebbe, Rav Chaim Cohn, not just in Yonei Choshen Mishpat, but in other matters as well. It's a schus to be here. And my role today is that of moderator. And I remember Rabbi Sher Zichrono Lebracha used to say that the role of the chairman or the moderator is to be a traffic cop, not to deliver drushes of his own. So, and I'm a Talmud of him as a Rebbe as well. So I'll just start by saying that I remember many moons ago when I was in law school that I enjoyed taking a course that was offered in law school called comparative law. Comparative law, and we had an opportunity to study certain subjects from a perspective of civil law, of secular law, and from the perspective of, in my case, Jewish law. And it was a very interesting academic comparison between the laws of against self-incrimination from a perspective of Jewish law versus the secular law and other issues that we may have touched upon at that time. But it was all a very academic dispute about comparing systems of law. For most of us who are here in the room today, for all of us who are here in the room today, knowing halacha, understanding what the Torah HaKadoshah has to say about Dinei Mominus, becoming acquainted with the basic facts and principles of Chaysh and Mishpat, those things are not just academic studies. That's our life, kihem chayenu. That's the way we have to conduct ourselves. And of course, we need to know also the din of the malchusa, the law of the land in which we live, to know what is considered legal and what's considered illegal. And very often, in doing the comparative part of it, we'll notice there may be some differences, and we need guidance in the real world. How do you deal with this? How do you deal with the fact that we are governed, as Torah Yidden, we are governed by halacha? At the same time, as citizens of this country, we are bound by the secular law of the society around us. And that's an enormous challenge, which comes up in so many different contexts, including the one we'll be speaking about here today. And we're very blessed to be able to hear on this particular topic, this very sensitive and, I will, of course, add, painful topic. I was surprised myself to hear in the discussions that we had before this gathering, in the discussions among the panelists, that this is not some isolated problem that comes up once every 5 years, every 10 years, but it's far more prevalent than any of us might imagine. These things are coming up with great frequency. Why they come up with great frequency in our community, I won't even speculate. Perhaps one of the panelists might have some observations and insights into that. But it's a serious problem, the concept of a Ponzi scheme, the victims, what to do for the victims, how the victims themselves have to conduct themselves al pi halacha, all kinds of shilas, which we will go into as we move forward in the morning discussion today. And I think, as I said before, we are very blessed that our two panelists today are people who are literally at the top of their respective fields, and they're not even respective fields. There's an interlapping between them, which often is the case because, as Eden, we live in both societies. We live in the Torah world. We are bound by Torah. What does Torah say when Dina de Malchusa points in a different direction? How to deal with those situations? And to be able to hear from Rav Chaim Kohn Shlita and from Rav Aaron Twersky Shlita, I'm humbled by sitting together with them at this table, looking out at this very hush of audience. But in fact, as we will see over the course of the next 45 minutes or so, there is enormous wisdom, there is tremendous contribution that Chaysh and Mishpat has to make to this entire discussion, which is binding upon us. And there is much to learn from one another. The format will be, I will first call upon Rav Aaron Twersky to offer certain opening general remarks from a legal and social perspective. We will then pose a number of specific shilas, halacha shilas, to Rav Kohn. Rav Kohn will respond to the shilas. Rav Aaron Twersky may wish to offer his own insight as well into some of these points. And then, time permitting, we will leave the floor open for questions from the audience. I would encourage people who want to ask a question to scribble it down on an index card or a piece of paper and pass it up to the front. We'll try to get to it. We may be able to take questions directly from the audience spontaneously as well. But without further ado, it's my special kavod and a schus for all of us to hear from Rav Aaron Twersky.
Lacombe picked the wrong person. He should have picked someone whose expertise is in bankruptcy law. And the last time I heard of bankruptcy law was when I was a law student. That's now 1965. So I am out of my expertise. I may have some general observations which still remain with me. You can't hear back there?
No.
Is this better?
Yeah.
Okay. You gotta sit right next to the mic. First, a general observation. The problem of Ponzi schemes is a subset of a greater ill. And although Cliff Cohn told me that this is not supposed to turn into a Moser Shmuz, I have observations to make. The prevalence of losses of huge sums of money over rather short periods of time is, in my opinion, part of a bigger problem, and that is, I will call it easy money. The belief that there is a free lunch, the belief that you can invest and get returns of 15 and 20% with very little risk, and that's just plain nonsense. Part of it is Ponzi schemes. Some of it, it often starts out not a Ponzi scheme. Somebody deal with an investor who's going to invest in real estate, and then he takes some losses, and after he takes some losses, he starts the Ponzi scheme to cover the losses that he has created. In fact, that is what happened with Bernie Madoff. He was a very, very legitimate investor of huge amounts of billions of dollars, but when he lost money, he covered it with the Ponzi scheme. Didn't start out as a Ponzi scheme, but later it turned out to be a Ponzi scheme. And this problem of easy money is, you wonder, and I've had people very close to me who have lost some great sums of money, and afterwards, you know, I wasn't consulted, but afterwards I looked at him and I said, "Mr. Mishigitzich, what did you do?" if you want to take risk, then you have to know what risks you're willing to live with. A recent young man in our community lost a huge amount of money based on investments. His total expertise in the real estate field was close to zero. He had some quick successes, and then people began throwing money at him. I have watched serious investors in the real estate area, and yes, they make money, but they don't make easy money. They work very hard. They clearly investigate the buildings. They take a huge amount of time and a huge amount of effort. It isn't easy money. It's hard money. Yes, it may be significant money, but it isn't easy money. They work very, very hard. If they if if they're involved in real estate ventures in other states, they may spend weeks and sometimes months at the sites getting all the information. So there is risk, but the risk is minimal. But when you're investing with somebody who you have very little knowledge of that person's expertise and background, you're asking for it. Now, if you want to invest and take high risks, you can do that with hedge funds. You can do that with on the market. You can take risk, and legitimate brokers will tell you, and investment counselors will tell you what the nature of your risks are. But blind risk makes absolutely no sense. And the belief that there is a pot of gold at the end of the rainbow is just impossible. And I don't understand. I really don't understand. I mentioned this to McCombe the other day. I said, it's desire people to get rich quick. And he said, no, it's not. It's a result of people wanting to be comfortable. Be that whether it's one or the other, it is still based on the premise that there is a free lunch. And I think that we have got to get the message out to their communities that there is no such thing as a free lunch. What you do and how you work out the fallout once these schemes have taken place is something that Cohen will address. American bankruptcy law has a list of priorities of who comes first, comes in second, comes in third. Some of that is relevant, but of course, most of the cases that we look at are not cases that end up in formal bankruptcy. So they will end up in Beth Cohen's lap, where he uses the Shulchan Aruch. If they would end up in bankruptcy, that would raise a whole range of different questions. I will tell you that I've looked some into the Madoff bankruptcy, and it is not anything that you can learn from, because it is a confluence of bankruptcy law and securities law, very, very complex. It has been up and down between the district court, the bankruptcy court, the Second Circuit, and appeals to the United States Supreme Court. It's extremely complex, and there is very little to learn from the Madoff bankruptcy to the situations that we are in. This was a scheme that was unparalleled in American history, where somebody ran off with, or had a Ponzi scheme of $20 billion, a fair amount of that has been recovered, and we have to deal with the question of also of recovery of what you can do in these minor schemes. I will tell you that I was sitting several years back with a justice of the United States Supreme Court, Sonia Sotomayor, just before she was appointed to the United States Supreme Court. And she asked me, and I had no answer for her, why is it that I see so many of your compatriots, your community, involved in huge schemes, bank fraud schemes, of huge amounts of money? And I had no answer for her. I still have no answer for her. But it is a perception that is there, and when they take place and people are caught and come before the criminal courts, the United States federal courts for sentencing, part of our problem is that we are now viewed as major, major criminal enterprises, and there is no rachmonis whatsoever. So I leave you with that. And we'll now turn to Levkon for specific guidance on areas in the schemes that he sadly sees every, if not every day, every week, or every month.
Shaykh Havarim, we're now going to pose some specific shaylas which we prepared in advance to Rav Kohn. And then following that, as I said, Be'ez Hashem, we'll have time, I hope, for questions from the audience. The first question is somewhat of a sensitive question. No, I take out the word somewhat of. The first question is a very sensitive question, Rav Kohn, and I'm very interested to hear your response to this one. I have been victimized by a Ponzi scheme. Can I call the feds? U.S. Attorney? The SEC? How about if I'm not absolutely certain that there's a scheme going on, but I'm suspicious of it? May I speak to anybody about that? Obviously, this is touching upon the simple matter of Mesira.
Chaim David, thank you for getting me into the hot seat. In case I have to be rescued, you will be the first one I will call upon. I don't have to say that Mesira is such. It's obvious. Well, I cannot really pull it. Okay, do you hear me now? Everybody hears me?
Yes. Good.
What do you say?
The
I have no volume.
Hi.
I plead innocence.
Talk straight in.
Okay, they told me to talk straight.
that's half the sentence.
Oh, okay. So I will talk straight into it.
All right.
Okay. Mesira, by the very nature and character of the subject, is extremely sensitive. For one, we need to understand in any kind of sentencing of people, the issue does not only concern the perpetrator, like the Torah tells us, Mishpotecho Tohoim Rabo. Mishpotim v'HaKadosh Baruch Hu have a ripple effect, but not only of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Any kind of verdict, sentencing, has a ripple effect. It's only HaKadosh Baruch Hu himself who is able to figure out the perfection of this ripple effect. Mesira, by nature and character, has a ripple effect that goes very far. It's not only because of the stigma of it, but because the character of the matter itself. Namely, you are telling on somebody else. Somebody is of your community, somebody is part of ourselves, a limb of myself. And consequently, the sensitivity on this subject is immense, rightfully so. But having said so, we have to understand that being part of a body that is called Klal Yisrael means that if one fails in his doings, by definition, he affected the rest of Klal Yisrael as well. And here we have defined balance. When on one hand, the perpetrator, if he did wrong something, or is being suspected to have done something wrong, anything that he will sentenced by and with will have an effect on him personally and everybody else who is affected by the ripple effect. On the other hand, there is always this aspect of taking care, charge of the community, as it was so pointedly mentioned by Professor Tversky. And this element is mentioned in Halacha. Namely, if a person turns into be a danger to the rest of the community, advertently or inadvertently, directly or indirectly, the rotzen be'oynes, doesn't matter, but he turns into a danger to the community, then the concept of Mesira becomes not only a specific issue for that person, it becomes an issue for everybody at large. And therefore, when those shailos come in front of a rov, it's extremely, extremely sensitive and difficult to paskin. It's almost to say that if I get up in the morning and I'm asking which shailos I should not be asked, Messiah is on the top of the list. Precisely because of that. I might be leaning to one and turn to be stringent on somebody else. In this specific situation of a Ponzi scheme, certainly a person who has a criminal mind, and there are people who have criminal minds, I for one do believe that 90% of people who get involved in Ponzi schemes have in this or other way of criminal mind. What do I mean by that? Many Ponzi schemes start out as legitimate investments or pseudo-legitimate investments. As it was already pointed out, then people think, we could make here a lot of money in short time. Easy money, as Professor Tversky mentioned. In this situation, already at the outset, you have all the elements that make it possible that eventually the Ponzi scheme should happen. And you need to have some real twisted or tweaked mind to do that. You're not only conservative, but you are either with somebody else's money. This in itself is already criminal. And I say that for a very simple reason. In Shulchan Aruch we have dinim related to a shoyma, to a guardian. It's very easy in halacha to turn into a shoyma socha. And once you become a shoyma socha, a paid guardian, the level of liability of a shoyma socha is beyond that you'd find in what you call secular law. Which means that anybody who learned the pretending halacha is involved in mitzvah or in Shulchan Aruch should have an alert level of extreme sensitivity once he takes somebody else's money. So if he doesn't do that, obviously either he slept over when he was learning in yeshiva, or there's some twist in his mind that makes it easy for him to take somebody else's money and play around with it. It must be so. And if this is the case, it's a pseudo-Ponzi scheme at the outset. Such a person, in my opinion, is a danger to the community. And it's proven. There are people who did it, were sentenced, went to jail, came out and did it again. Now, what is here so fascinating, if I may call it fascinating for the observer, not so much for the person who invested money, is that people who know that this fellow was already once a time sentenced, put into jail for having exactly those kind of schemes, do not hesitate to put money again with him. To use the euphemism of the Gemara. The whole is the thief and also the mouth, both. And here, when this shaila comes in front of the dying, so is he permitted to turn him in or is he not? Well, why did you put your money in this investment in the first place? Were you really so innocent? On the other hand, maybe he was innocent. And maybe this person, meaning the schemer or the scammer, whatever you call him, is a danger to the community. So therefore, obviously, it's a very, very delicate question. And I cannot give a definitive answer. I could give you the parameters of it. Sometimes you have a situation when the one who took the money became a roidev. A simple roidev. You don't have to be a roidev in terms of killing somebody else if put in danger people or the community at large. Halachically speaking, it's a loch of a roidev as well. So I'm asked here on this point to answer a question which basically you would need as an Sanhedrin. Said Chaim David, you know, in the best of terms, and I appreciate you very much, but how could I be a substitute for Bezin? If you're telling me about Chaim Cohen, don't you answer those questions? Sometimes I do, yes. But I just gave you the parameters of it. We need to know who is the Roidiv and who is the Nirdav. Usually, B'derach Klal, many often I'm telling people, you know, the Shilu Kitna said, Elokim Evakesh HaNirdav. HaKadosh Baruch Hu Evakesh. He's going to, you know, usually you translate it, he will rescue the Nirdav, the one who's being chased. So he said, why does it Evakesh HaNirdav? Yatzil HaNirdav, he's going to rescue him. The question is, who is the Roidiv and who is the Nirdav? And sometimes both are Rotfim and Nirdofim at the same time. And therefore, the Shikla does in this kind of situations to find out exactly what's the right opinion to, and attitude to take to decide such a matter depends extremely on the particular situation. But yes, sometimes there's a permission and maybe even a mitzvah to turn him in. And sometimes you cannot do it.
Sometimes somebody who's clearly a Nirdofim, really a victim, not at all at fault. And they'll come and ask the question, can they cooperate? And there are several aspects to it. One is, and I think one you alluded to, is that the moment you start an investigation, it has tentacles. It reaches out. It reaches out to people, some innocent, some guilty, but people who are once an investigation starts, you can't put your finger in the dike and say stop it. You can just go after the perpetrator, because once the United States Attorney gets into the case, they will do the investigation and they will run into people who were other investors, but whose own financial situation is precarious. A couple of weeks ago, I sent someone to Lev Cohen, and he was clearly a victim. He invested legitimately into a very legitimate thing. It turned out that the perpetrator had lied to him and had lied to other people as well. And this person says, look, my business is quite legitimate. I'm above board. But I don't want the government looking at my entire business, because once they start looking, comes up Shepard, and that's a reality. So it becomes a very, very difficult question. And so what I said, you need to talk to two people. You need to talk to Rav Cohen, and you need to talk to a criminal lawyer to understand that whether or not you have any jeopardy in going after them, because what government may do once they get the investigation. So it's very, very tricky.
Well, I second your motion. Professor Twerst, I second your motion. Yeah. There's nothing to add to this, it's right too. I hope the fellow didn't come back to you to tell you what I told him. I hope so. Okay,
I'm glad we came to some clarity on that point. Which brings us to our next question. Okay, now let's get back into the direct area of what happens when the Ponzi scheme is revealed to be a Ponzi scheme, and the whole thing collapses, and our schemer or scammer, I like that nusach, our schemer or scammer owes lots and lots of money to a lot of people, but only has a fraction of the money to repay. How are the remaining assets to be divided among the victims? Is there any kadima among the victims, first in, first out, depending on the size of your investment? What are the parameters for recovery of whatever assets are remaining?
Okay, I will start from the end and go back, so to say. The short of it would be that certainly we are going to look to separate between recovering people's principal versus profits, and also at a time that people invested money. What I do mean by that is not who was first in terms, first come, first served, but in a situation when it's not clear when did this investment turn into an actual Ponzi scheme, this will also have here something to say. It will be a factor to be considered in the distribution of the assets. Now, I must familiarize you with principles of halacha. I think this particular case here that we're discussing is a classic example how one could learn Shulchan Aruch, but nevertheless have no clue how to apply it halacha lemaisa. Why? Because simply one needs to understand the terms of halacha applied to today's commerce and how it is functioning. If you learn Hilchos Gneiva, you've learned the halachos pertaining to a person stealing, recovering any kind of stolen assets, and so on and so forth. We are talking about three kinds of assets. Real estate, given over to somebody else. Movable assets, which we call metaltelin, or cash. Now, let's talk about cash. Cash, in the classic sense of the halacha, means, we say in Yiddish, grine. You take a dollar, a real dollar, this is considered cash. If I invest money with cash, means that I took whatever X amount of dollars, I took them as they are, brought them cash to the investor, he took the money and made business with it. This is, in our days and time, almost distinct. It does not exist. It does not exist almost. People usually don't take they don't take a briefcase full of money and bring it over to the investor and say, here you have it.
You haven't been at a closing.
Are you in real estate? We're talking about schemes, Mark. We talk about schemes, not about real estate. Oh, should I speak about cash?
Yeah.
Okay.
Check.
Halachically speaking, if you talk about cash in real estate, and I recommend my good friend Mark to take care of you. So then, what we're talking about here is that if the money at the outset was taken for the purpose of not investing it in real investments, so then the person who took the money at the outset became a thief, a gunner. So he stole the money. Once he stole the money, so then we have now to consider if anything that he invested his money in, if this still remains the persons who gave the money, the investors, or does it belong to the thief? Now the thing is that purely logically speaking, if you steal money and take this money, you steal money. When you buy something, so the thief owns it. It's his, in principle. That's what it is. So here, if Mr. Punchy, Charles Punchy, took the money and took the cash at the real estate closing, it was a Ponzi scheme. So therefore, if he took the money and bought something with it, it belongs to the thief. Wonderful. You like it?
Sounds good.
Sounds good. Okay. Having said so, I'm not going to discuss the situations of this. I'm not going to even talk about a case where originally money was given to the investor and was given to the agent to invest it, and he took it for that purpose. In other words, he did not intend to steal it, but he mishandled the money. He invested it in a fashion, or gave it, or bought something, whatever there should be, in a fashion which he was not entitled to handle the money with. In those situations, there are different opinions in halacha, how to consider the recovery of those assets. This is not so much pertaining to us, and I will tell you why. Because in most cases, excluding from a closing in a real estate deal, when we talk about in a Ponzi scheme, usually you're talking about Mr. Investor, so-called investor, calling the schemer or scammer, how should I call him? Scammer or schemer? How should I call him? I don't know. Broker. Oh, sorry. So, yeah, calls up the broker, so-called broker, okay, and tells him, please, invest into this gorgeous idea that you have and just make as much profit as you can. what's happening is that the investor calls up his bank, orders that money should be transferred to an account, either to the direct account of the person handling the money, or to an escrow account, he wants to make it more professional. And then you have also the lawyer being part of the scheme. And in such a situation, money eventually being released again, you have the money being released from the lawyer who held his money, so to say, in an escrow account, and move it on to the broker and handle the money. Okay, so we don't really have money here. It's true that people usually view money in an account to be having their money deposited over there. The truth of the matter is, you don't have a vault over there. There's no vault. You don't have anything where you put your cash in. What you have here is that you went to the teller, deposited your check, your cash even, doesn't matter. At that moment, what happens is the relationship between you and the bank is of a lender and a borrower. In this particular case, it happens to be that you are the lender and the bank is the borrower. Consequently, they have an obligation to pay you back, as a borrower has to the lender, which is called in halacha a shibut. The shibut. There's this famous joke that they say that Napoleon learned collateral kula, but there were two particular subjects that he said he never understood. One is migo, and the other one is shibut. It's a mixed opinion. It's not it's nishahin, nishahir. It's near there, whatever it is. It's a shibut. And the question will be if there's a shibut from the goy to a yid. That's a separate story. And as you know very well, in halacha, we have the famous principle of kimli, which means when it comes to the Torah, then if there are opinions that would hold a particular position, that therefore you're not able to obligate the perpetrator to pay, he's potter. Beden cannot pass in his chayv. So you have an issue here. The issue that you're talking about here is not altogether that here the broker took my money, cash, and invested it somewhere. He never took my money. He only received a notice from the bank, from his bank, that money, so to say, quote unquote, were transferred from the investor's account to his account, or to the lawyer's account, whatever it should be. So then what really happens is that the shibut that was originally from the investor's bank to the investor now turned to be a shibut from the bank of the so-called broker or his lawyer. What changed was only an agreement between those two banks and the people who, so to say, own those accounts to change the shibutim, to change the obligations of payment from the bank of the investor to the bank of the broker. That's what happens. So we don't have the classic situation of Geneva. We don't have that altogether. The mind of Kimine. So I will tell you something. We'll tell you my personal opinion. What would happen if there is a legitimate situation? If there is a legitimate situation of people having borrowed money legitimately and don't have sufficient funds to pay off, how do we divide, if there are remaining assets, how do we divide them between the lenders? There's a principle machlokes in the Rishonim about it, a difference of opinions in the Rishonim about it. But the prevailing minhag is to pasken like those opinions to hold that we divide it per ratio, which means that if people invested, let's say, $1 million, other people invested $500,000, the third one $100,000, so then whatever money there is, it will be distributed according to the ratio of the investment. Which is not so simple in Shulchan Aruch. In Shulchan Aruch it says otherwise. But there are opinions with the Chief Sarach who holds like this. The Or HaShulchan said the minig is to either hold by the sheet or to mefasha, or to come to some kind of a compromise. But if my information is correct, and I see that it's Bederachkal handled, today, Bederachkal, what we do is we have it distributed per ratio. So that's what happened. Now, the same situation in a case of Gzela, like we're talking here. So, you know, the following would happen. I think so. Let's see first what really happened here. We have, let's say, Chase Manhattan, which is the bank of the investor, instructed to transfer money to Citibank, which is the bank of the agent, of the broker. It turns out that the money, the money that now is being handled, so to say money, that's being handled by Citibank on behalf of the agent, was taken falsely under conditions which were completely false, incorrect, and consequently, if, let's say, Citibank, who is the broker's bank, would have known that this money came into their account is fraudulent, then certainly it's clear, at least to me, it's clear to me that court would have ordered right away that the shibut, that the obligations of payment should be to the original owner of the money and not to this broker. The broker is a thief. And consequently, this money, the shibut of the money is not altogether to the broker, to the account holder, but to the real owner of the money. And I think even Mark, my good friend, would agree with that. If this would come into courts, they would say right away, this is how you should handle the money. Return it, or it really belongs to the owner of the original bank account, the one who is the holder of the bank account of Chase. If this is the case, it would be my opinion that Halacha would follow through in that as well. Follow suit, as you say. Namely, that he would say, we have to look at what is the bank doing here? What is the bank doing here in terms of meshabit themselves, obligating themselves to whoever is the account holder? If it's clear, bedin and abachusa, if it's clear in banking regulations that the shibudim are going to be to the one whose money was taken in a fraudulent fashion, then we are saying that this is exactly how the shibud is happening. The first shibud, as it was perceived to be, namely from the Citibank, so to say, now owed money to the broker because the transfer from Chase to Citi never happened. Never happened. It still stayed in the account of the original account holder, which is Chase. And if this is the case, it would be a case for a forensic accountant to find out exactly how the money moved around. And when you find out that the money was moved around, we are able to go back to the origin of the money and to determine where was the original shibud. And I think this is the key, the answer to this question. In this particular case, when we are not talking about distributions of halvot, which were obtained in a legitimate fashion, when we're talking about a Ponzi scheme where the outset, the transfer, when a transfer of money was done in a fraudulent fashion, then what we will have to do is to track back how exactly the shibudim started at the outset. And then, we don't have to tell you, as I said now, it's the job of a forensic accountant to make here his good services and to follow through and find out exactly how the money should be distributed.
Assuming that we cannot track the money, and we basically have investors who have been scammed, and assuming also that that the scammer has not only taken money from
broker,
from the broker is not taking money from the that's not the only monies that are involved, but assuming that the person who did the scam here also borrowed significant amounts of money, what is the relationship between now a lender and an investor?
Right. So here, let's just maybe make it more, how should I say, real. It might be that the broker, besides having proposed to people a good investment, borrowed money. It might be that it was straightforward ribbis, which happens all the time, unfortunately. Or even taking money at the risk, when at least half of the money is a straightforward loan. And it might be argued that even the Hedeka Iska, in that respect, might be considered like a loan. I don't want to enter the discussion, which would be an halachic discussion. But there's no question about it that in this particular case, he, namely, the scammer, broker, that he, whatever had in his account, if the forensic is not able to determine how the money was manipulated, the first obligation would be to the people who lent money to him. There's no question about it. So this would be now that we have to distribute it. The question would be different. The question would be if it happens in a different situation, you could track back the money. Then another principle, we're getting late, right? There's another principle here to be considered, which is the famous concept of Shibud Rav Noson. Meaning, if I owe you and you owe somebody else, so then the last party could come back to me, or the first party could come back to me and collect from me. So this might be something situation of Shibud Rav Noson.
In general, bankruptcy law puts the investor way below the lender. In other words,
yeah. One second. Yes, sir. What is it? Yeah, please.
In general, bankruptcy law puts the investor at the bottom of the totem pole, right. And lenders have priority because it goes, basically, the more risk that you have, the less right you have to recover.
Right, but here again, as I said, there's a situation of, should we have lost, might be sometimes. So it would be, I'll give you as much of a clear answer like the first question I ended, you know, something similar. Yeah, okay. Please, next year, yeah. Did you end all the questions?
We're going to, I thought the questions were answered beautifully.
Thank you. He is the, are you the Daf Yochid?
We're going to break, Be'ez Hashem, at 12:15, so we've got close to 15 minutes. I'm going to ask one more of the prepared questions, then a few questions have come in from the audience, so let's see if we can be Makatze. Let's pretend for a minute that somebody recouped his investment early on before the scheme exploded, right? And he now has money, and this was money that was procured through illegal means, right, originally. He didn't know that when he retook his investment. At that point, what are his obligations? Does he need to return the money that he has recouped? What about if he's already used that money, if he's given it to an organization? How do you deal with that situation?
Okay, so based on the principle I mentioned to you earlier, the first distinction will have to be made between profits and principal. Certainly, we are able to, via the forensic accountant, to determine that it was his money and it was channeled this way, so then regardless of the other victims, he got back his principal. As profits are concerned, there are no profits, so he has to give it back. So this amount of money will have to be put back into a general account, and then this general account will be distributed pro ratio. That would be really the solution or the answer to this question. What was another question there?
Well, again, what about if he's already used the money and he's given, including the profits money, he's given a nice contribution to the Business Halacha Institute? what would be the obligation of the Business Halacha Institute in that?
Yeah, ask another question.
I plead the fifth.
As a moderator, I have the right not to say that he made the check out to Agudas Yisrael. So.
Of America, of Canada. Jokes aside, certainly if you're talking about again, if it's principle, it's the same answer. Right. If it's principle, it is. If it's profit, it's to return it. If you give it to an organization, well, again, the same story. As far as I'm concerned, I don't care how far it carries. If the shibudim are being now retroactively determined to be false, so then, you know, there's a pasuk, I think, somebody, Novi Koshal Ozul Nofaloza? No, Koshal Oida Nofalozul. Right, yes.
Okay, very good. You say
puting,
don't
you?
Yeah, absolutely.
Isn't, I mean, it's very nice from a halachic point of view, all the halachas that you talked about.
People can't hear what Mark is saying. I'm sorry. People can't hear what Mark is saying. Yeah.
I'll speak loud.
Moshe.
Here on Moshe. The closing on Mark.
All the things that you said halachically, oiskahalten, and it's very good.
Thank you.
But isn't there a strong union in halacha also? Of what commerce provides today, everything is wired, everything is transferred into accounts this way. So to say halachically, it's not the same thing as actual money. That it's just a transfer of accounts. How does the halacha of the inyone commerce, how commerce looks at it in each generation, affect it?
My best good friend Moshe, please. Catapult yourself back 40 plus years into Mir Yeshiva when we were sitting together on the bench. And please understand that I could not care less how commerce looks at this or people in the broad perception understand it. We here have an obligation to look at it, not obligation, the correct way to do it is, yes, to look at it, how does Allah view this kind of commerce? So I know, and my good friend Ari, Baba Marbago, told me at the outset, you are going to have difficulties to explain people that a deposit in today's commerce is not cash. So I see that, but for that, I would call on a good friend of mine who is a psychologist, you know, and would offer his services. It has nothing to do with Aloha. In Aloha, we have to look at it still. S-T-E-I-R-E-I-L-E. Still. With an E in the end or without?
Yeah.
Okay, so yeah. Which means that we have to look at it simply what happens here. In today's commerce, what we have is shibudim. If you came to this event here, this year, only to hear this little information, I'm not talking about the clothing that you do with cash, not a briefcase, I'm not talking about that one. But I guess there is some kind of situations when this is not the case, you know? Okay.
Okay, there are two more questions that were sent up from the audience, which I think are interesting. Let's pretend I'm the publisher of a newspaper, and I solicit advertisements, and an advertisement comes in that offers a 20% return per month on an investment. As the newspaper publisher, should I accept that ad?
It's a question to me or to the publisher? I don't know. I would say it's better not. Anything, you know, as you know very well, we have our saying, any return over 12% is nishke shale for ribis. Straightforward value.
Okay, you have a follow-up question there somewhere? Follow-up, go ahead.
Speak up.
Belt it out.
So I'll read the ad. That was my question.
Ah, there you go.
Now don't tell us which paper.
I won't say which paper, but I'll read the ad. And then I had a follow-up to it, and I'll tell you
what. Oh, boy.
The ad
is that 15 minutes, don't we?
All right. It's a short ad. In many newspapers, they have a business opportunity section. The newspapers have what's called the business opportunity section, right? So the ad ran, and this ran close to 2 years. It says, experienced NASDAQ day trader seeks investing partner averaging 20%.
Sounds made of. That sounds made of.
Low risk, high return. After
but Madoff never get 20. Madoff give 8%.
Well, this guy was better than Madoff. This is a professional, clearly. After complaints to the paper pulled this ad, reran it as now 3,000, 5,000 daily. After another complaint, the ad changed, everything else staying the same, 10,000 weekly. And then after the third version, it was pulled, but a new ad came in. After the fourth version of the ad, the paper stopped running these type of financial ads in the business opportunity section.
Okay, I will tell the paper not to do it.
Well, Okay. How can you turn down the $50 per month, I guess, right?
Okay. Thank you for your comment.
You mentioned earlier that oftentimes a Ponzi scheme begins as a legitimate
not
investment.
Always. In the case of NATO, for example, it's not a legitimate.
In certain cases, it begins as a legitimate enterprise, and then when it starts having losses, the investor will, the syndicate or whatever will cover the losses by turning it into a Ponzi scheme. People who receive all their money and profits before it turned into a Ponzi scheme, do we look at the entire thing as a Ponzi scheme, or do we have to judge at what point it turned into a Ponzi scheme?
Give the answer. You're coming to the shiurim every week. The answer is.
We have to look at the...
Not the fire, that was funny. Thank you. Next
one. Yeah,
I understand. Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
We know that the answer includes the word l'chayra, but we don't know more than that. Do they give the rest of it? I think if I understood what was happening over there, the answer was that, in fact, you would have to draw the line between that part of the investment that was made, those investments that were made prior to it turning into a Ponzi scheme. Right, there's a magical moment when this becomes a Ponzi scheme, and if you can pinpoint that moment and know when the investment took place, right? That's obviously not so simple to pinpoint that moment. Obviously,
yeah.
We've given a lot of work to the forensic accountants in the audience.
Yeah. Moshe, yeah, this is Moshe. Listen, Mark, this is Moshe.
Yeah, I'm a little bit depressed. Oi. My good friend of Khan just told me I have no money anymore. Just shibudim.
But I could give you a good bit of advice. I'm willing to take much of your shibudim.
And accordingly, our dear friend Mark was speaking about the suitcase. Then the suitcase isn't money either.
Well, you don't
so
want...
The notes, bills are not the
My dear Moishi. As old friends from Vienna, you shouldn't argue our neighbor from Seifer. And now away from Vienna. Who paskened that banknotes have a din like cash? Right.
So maybe you would have paskened that the deposit is also
special. No. But you know what? We have the subject for next year, if you wish. Thank you very much. That's it?
No, one more. Brocha Chrita?
Brocha Chrita.
Brocha Chrita, we're going to pull on.
You're permitted to sing in the middle.
For the Bracha Achrita, it's a special privilege to call on our Chaver, Reb Chanoch Lubling, to offer a perspective either from his work with Klein Edison for many, many years, or as his work as the head of our prisoners' rights program at Agudas Yisrael, which I think might be relevant. That might be relevant to our conversation.
I'm not going to talk about neither. I want to talk about, to spend 60 seconds to talk about BHI. Number one, you all came, so you all know how unique BHI is. But if you think about it, I don't think there's any medical doctor, medical organization where you could pick up the phone, a stranger could pick up the phone and ask medical questions. I don't know of any. I don't think there's any legal corporation, any partnership or any lawyer who has open phone. You can just pick up a stranger and ask for legal opinions. And I don't think it's true of forensic accountants or anything else. But BHI, there's Rabbanim, who you can mamish pick up the phone anytime, call up, ask a shayla. They don't ask you your address. They don't ask you your telephone number. They give you an answer. And where do you find that? And whose organization? So who's going to support such an organization? This is our organization, and it's really the Klaus organization. Every one of us should feel an obligation to support such an organization. And this brunch is probably the major resource. It's the only resource, really the only fundraiser we have during the year. And we all know the chashivas of chayshe mishpit, and we all know how much preventive medicine is better than medicine after people get sick. So there's a table in the back. We take briefcases with cash, we take checks, shibudim,
no profit.
You take shibudim? Right.
And there's a credit card machine, so please, if you haven't done so on the way out, do whatever you can to help us continue.